Thank you, Boo. My name is Bob M. I'm an alcoholic. This is amazing, and I'll tell you why a little later. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I communicated with Michael S., and he set me up with everything I needed. And I thank Lyle for picking me up at the airport and taking me on a nice sightseeing tour and getting me down here. As I was driving down, I thought, man, all these grapes, we could make some good wine. But somebody else has probably already thought of that. A couple of my buddies, Ernest and Julio, probably come up with that years ago. I'm a class of 72. I got that from California. I got sober in 1972. I didn't mean to get sober. I got sober of a mistake. I got one Monday morning, the worst Monday of my life, and the first thought is, I'm going to get drunk. And but I hate to just go out and get drunk. You look bad when you do that, and especially early in the morning. So I went to the lumber yard, and I got a load of lumber. And I figured, that looks good. You got your truck, you got a load of lumber. Bob really out there working. The guy at the lumber yard invited me to lunch. And it surprised me because no one ever invited me to lunch. So I went to lunch. I figured, I went in this, we have an Alano Club there in Tucson. And they have six sandwiches. And the top one is grilled cheese. You know, they always have that. The grilled cheese was 25 cents, but the big one at the bottom, hot roast beef with mashed potatoes and gravy, $1.29. So I was going to sock it to this guy. I thought, I'll never see him again. I went for the big one at the bottom. And he bought my lunch, and he was a real nice guy, and he talked about alcoholism, and I admitted to having a problem with alcohol, but I was working on it. I mean, it didn't get by me that I was having trouble with alcohol. You know, I come up with a foolproof plan. I was going to get me a 12-pack, and I was going to drink the 12-pack. And then the next day, I was only going to drink 11. The next day, I was only going to drink 10. And you can see where I'm going. In 10 days, I'd be a non-drinker. I'd be over it. I'd be cured. I never accomplished that. But it was a good plan. I thought if I could just hang on to this plan, I'd be a non-drinker. Anyway, this guy kept talking about alcohol and stuff, and it was kind of embarrassing. I tried to get him off the subject, but he wouldn't. He took me to the Alano Club. You know what that is. But he gave me the little pamphlet, Is AA for You? 12 questions. So simple. Now, a simple question. He said, Bob, ask yourself these questions. You know, like, have you ever had a drink in the morning? Well, of course. Some mornings you're going to die if you don't have a drink. So you drink those mornings. I didn't drink every morning. I have to work a lot, you know. And things like, would your life be better off if you didn't drink? Well, I'd have more money right up front there. Is alcohol causing problems in your family? Well, my family was back east on vacation. But they bought one-way tickets. That should have told me there's a problem here, but I thought, wait a minute, that's more money for me to drink on. I'll send the money later to come back. But they never call and ask for money to come home. But the only one I could answer yes was, have you ever had blackouts due to drinking? I answered no. I mean, well, I didn't remember having any blackouts. So I said no to that one. And he said, well, just check your score in the back. And in the back it says, If you answer yes to one of these, you got a problem. If you answer yes to as many as three, you're definitely an alcoholic, and we recommend Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, yuck. The last thing I want to be is an alcoholic. I have enough problems. But I tried to convince him that my problem was insanity. Now, I'd cop to that. I was insane because I know a lot about insanity. I used to visit my relatives in the insane asylum. Now, they didn't seem crazy to me. And I often wondered, well, what are they doing here? Here they were in the insane asylum. But they were just normal as far as I was concerned. But I was doing what they were doing just before they were locked away. And so I knew that I had big blanks in my life. You know, I'd go along and then, boom, a big blank space. And I didn't know what happened during that blank space. And it was hard to clean it up sometimes. So I told him I was probably insane. And he kept talking about alcohol, and then he said something that has me here today. He said, Bob, I believe that if you don't drink alcohol, the insanity will leave your life, and it won't come back as long as you don't drink alcohol. I thought, wow, what a deal. To go from insane to sane, all I would have to do is give up alcohol. Now, I wasn't having that much fun with alcohol. I've had my fun with alcohol. But I wasn't having that fun with alcohol anymore the way I used to have it, the way I sought it. It just wasn't there. And I was prepared to give it up. Of course, I know what not drinking is. I used to not drink between my drunks. You just don't drink as long as you can, then you drink. So that's the way I quit. And he said, Bob, you'll get everything you need to not drink one day at a time right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't believe him, but he was such a nice guy. And after all, he'd bought my lunch. So I thought I'd try it. I'll just see. And so I tried not drinking. You know, there's a lot of talk about sponsorship, and I heard a lot of talk about sponsorship later on, but I would never ask anybody to be my sponsor. They must have saw that when they looked at me. And this fella introduced me to a temporary sponsor. And this guy had 7 years of sobriety, and that was impressive, that 7 years without drinking. So he pointed out, well, this is kind of the program. He was kind of a no nonsense guy, but I told him that I couldn't. We talked about working the steps, and well, there they are, right where they left them. And I said, well, I couldn't work those steps because I'm not on speaking terms with God. You know, I knew God. And I had avoided him a long time. Way back when I was a kid, I grew up in the Bible Belt down in the South. And my parents used to talk about Jesus a lot and just about God and about all that stuff out there. And it just scared me to death. And they told me that God was always watching you. And if you do something right, if you sin, you're going to hell and you're going to burn forever. I wouldn't want to spend 10 minutes there, much less an eternity in a place like that. But this was scary. And the worst part about it is you'd go to hell if you did it. But if you just thought about doing it, you'd go. And all I could think about was doing it. I just wanted to do it all the time. But I couldn't do it. And I try not to think about it. And the more I try not to think about it, the more I thought about doing it. But anyway, I was 15 years old in a little town, Jonesboro, Georgia, just right out of Atlanta. And we had a pool room right in the middle of town. And I used to walk by that pool room and just the smell of booze coming out of the pool room door would make me high. It would just make me tingle all over. I'd just smell it, and I would tingle, and I just loved the tingle. Probably sinful, but I loved it. I asked my folks if I could just go in the pool hall. Now, I wouldn't shoot pool. That was really sinful. You'd go straight to hell for that. And I wouldn't drink beer. I just wanted to go in the pool hall and just sit there. They said, "Oh, no. You go in that pool hall and God will strike you down dead." And that's pretty severe for a young fella. And I wasn't about to go in that pool hall. But this Saturday morning, I had walked by six times and I got my tingles going. You know, I just, man, it would just tingle me. And I couldn't stand it any longer. I thought I'd just soon be dead. And I walked in. I opened the door and I walked in. And I stood just inside the door and I waited. Nothing happened. It was all a big lie. The whole thing was a big lie. So from then, I just kicked all the stops out. And I just did my thing. And it still felt sinful to drink. But thank God there's a denomination called Southern Baptist. And the Southern Baptist don't drink. It's total abstinence in the Southern Baptist. Unless, of course, you have respiratory trouble, stomach trouble, bad case of nerves or anything like that. And then it's okay to take just a little bit as medicinal purposes. You don't take it in the house. That's sinful. You leave it in the trunk of your car. You don't invite anybody to share your bottle. That's sinful. But anytime you feel a little queasy, a little tightness of breath, you just walk out, open your trunk, take a pull of medication, tighten the top back up, put it back in, and close the lid. And if it wasn't for Southern Baptist, I wouldn't be here today. Because I had a lot of anxiety, a lot of shortness of breath, and I carried a lot of booze in my trunk. And I never drank publicly until I was 18 years old. And I had a sponsor into drinking. You don't just walk in and drink if you're had the kind of education I have. It's just too sinful. So I was down at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And the guys were going down to the slop chute and drinking openly. It was so sinful. And I just, well, I wanted to go, but I was afraid to. And my sponsor into drinking said, "Well, Bob, it can't be a sin if Uncle Sam condones it. It can't possibly be a sin if Uncle Sam says it's okay." And right there on base, you don't have to be 21. 18 is all you have. Well, you don't even have to be 18 if you. But right there on base, they sold us tall bottles of Budweiser, 5 cents. The limit was 3. So I finally walked in there and I bought myself 3 bottles. And I looked around and they had all the condiments that go with it. They had glasses and tables and chairs and stuff like that. But there was about 30 people in line. And the way it was is you had to turn in your 3 empties when you got the full one. So I just got back in line. Now, you can hold 2 and drink 1 and then switch off. And it worked out just right. By the time I got back to the cash register, I turned in my 3 empties, got 3 full ones, and got back in line. And I thought, hallelujah! This social drinking didn't feel a bit sinful. And now, my drinking went downhill from there. If you can just imagine, downhill from there. My mother was an alcoholic, and she quit drinking at age 16. She got drunk one day at 16, and you know how women can be overbearing sometimes. Well, she wanted to drive her boyfriend's car. And he didn't want her to, but the more she drank, the more overbearing she got. Well, finally he cranked it up and she got behind the wheel and she drove it right into the well. And it was so embarrassing. She never drank again. She could equate drinking with driving the car into the well. And the best thing to do is just not drink. And so when she died at age 84, she had 56 years sobriety. Now, she never come to AA. She used her methods to not drink. My dad was an alcoholic, but he drank until I was age 2. And he was a peddler. He sold stuff. Well, you know, you guys, Lyle was telling me about Peddler's Day on Saturday up here in Clovis. He had a truckload of watermelons, and he was taking them to market to sell, or to door-to-door, or however you sell melons. And he stayed home drinking too long, just a little too long. And he headed to town, and the old bridges that used to go over railroads and things, they had these steel sides that went up and over and down the other side. And he had one eye closed as he was approaching this bridge, and he got a little far, just too far to the right, and he ran up it and flipped the truck and busted every watermelon in that truck. That wasn't the clincher. He had my oldest brother with him, and my mother come down, laid the law down, and my dad quit drinking. So the RAND report of 1977 says that if one of your parents is an alcoholic, your chances are 50-50, the 50% chance you'll be an alcoholic. If both of your parents are alcoholics, the chances are 100% that the offsprings will be alcoholics. And my parents had 10 little alcoholic children. But nobody warned us. If the doctor said, "Mrs. Morse, you have a healthy little alcoholic here, just keep him away from booze and he'll be okay," I would have been forewarned. But nobody said that. They just pushed me out in the cruel world and said, "Don't drink. It's a sin." And I really tried. I just couldn't handle it. I just couldn't not drink. I'll tell you a little story. I went in to buy some. I have a ranch there in southern Arizona, and I raise beef cattle. But I love chickens. I don't know why. I've got this thing about chickens. I just love chickens. And so I went in and I bought some chickens, and I bought 33. It was the end of the season. That's all he had, 50 cents a piece. And he said, "Well, why don't you buy these ducks?" He said, "I got 8 ducks left over. They're the same price. Take them." So I said, "Okay, throw them in there." So I went home with my 33 chickens and 8 ducks, and I just turned them loose in the front yard, and they just run around the place. And the ducks thought they were chickens. They, you know, they were the majority. The chickens were the majority, and so the ducks just kind of followed them around. And they had this little watering thing. It's a little like a fruit jar with a little ring of water around it. And they all drank together. And they grew up together in the front yard. Well, the ducks were about 8 months old. They were getting big. And one day, I cut the end out of a big water tank. It was big. You know, it was about at least 4 feet, maybe 5 feet across. And I cut the end out. And I'm standing there looking at it. And I thought, you know, that would make a good watering trough. So I drug it over to the hose, and I started running water in it, not thinking about anything. And all of a sudden, those ducks come running. The first time they had ever seen water in their life. They knew exactly what to do with that water. They all hit that water, and they swam back and forth and back and forth across that water. It was bred into them. See, they knew exactly what to do. Isn't that kind of like an alcoholic? All you have to do is add alcohol. And I was just, I was always attracted to alcohol, attracted to alcoholics, attracted to drinking. I just wanted to drink. And I didn't know why. But now I know why. I'm an alcoholic. I was born an alcoholic. I've been an alcoholic all my life. And I used to feel bad about that. And I hear a lot of people talk about feeling bad because they're alcoholics. And I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. They've set me straight on that. There's a place in the Big Book that says, be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. The religious people are right a lot of the time. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. And the religious people tell me that I was created in God's own image. And I have to accept that. That's what they believe. We're all created in God's own image. But I was created an alcoholic. That means God's an alcoholic. Right? God's also a non-alcoholic. God's both male and female. He's all things to all people. So my alcoholism is not a bad thing. The Big Book tells me that God is everything good. His realm is goodness. And if he's an alcoholic, then my alcoholism is not a bad thing. I used to curse my alcoholism. I used to curse alcohol. But I give that up. You know, it was important that I drink an allotted amount of alcohol. Being born an alcoholic, we have to drink alcohol. It's just the way it is. There's three types of people on this planet. There's people that make things happen. There's people that let things happen. And there's people that wonder what happens. The alcoholics all fall in the first category. We make things happen. We're the people that go to the ends of the earth. We're the type A people in this society. You know, we're the ones who go to the moon. Only an alcoholic would go to the moon. A non-alcoholic would sit home and watch it on TV. God in his infinite wisdom knew that it would take 10% of people like us to make this world go round and around and around. If it wasn't for us, we'd all be sitting on the East Coast in tall, skinny houses. Everything two blocks back would be a vast wasteland. Nobody would go west. If you're sitting on the East Coast and your barn is full and you got money in the bank and everybody loves you and they say there's a wagon train going west, forget it. But if you're an alcoholic, you've spent all your money and you've stolen a little and nobody loves you anymore and the sheriff is wishing you'd leave, guess who signs up? Whatever's out there has got to be better than here. You know, we created the geographical. And that's why we went all the way around this planet. You know, it just all makes sense today. I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous to straighten it out for me. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know who I am. I know what I am. I know where I came from, and I know where I'm going. And that's a good feeling. I don't know what tomorrow holds for me, but I know who holds tomorrow. He's a friend of mine, so I don't sweat it. I've been here before. I was here and about 25 or 30 years ago. Back then, Northern H&I and Southern H&I used to get together once a year and have a convention. And I went up here to Fresno about, 25 or 30 years ago. I was on a mission. I wanted to steal something. I wanted to steal what H&I had in California and bring it to Tucson. And that's what I did. There's no reason for me to have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, you guys have been here a long time. You've been doing it a long time. And all I had to do was do what you did. We had nothing in Arizona. Well, today we have quite a bit. It looks remarkably like H&I in California, but we just finished our sixth corrections conference there in Arizona, and it was wonderful. We've opened the doors to the wardens and the corrections officers and the program directors and the people in the prisons, and we have the people who, like myself, are cleared and go into prisons. And we have inmates that come to this thing. And we had a really nice turnout, and it's really great. Now, I've been in H&I since 1973, early 1973. I didn't plan to go. I don't like prisons. I never did. Well, I'm getting to like them now. But my grandfather served 44 years in the Georgia State Prison. And I used to go visit him, and I didn't like it. It just, everybody had big numbers on their chest, and he just had three digits in his number. He'd been there since 1928. And I didn't like the prison. I didn't like the whole setup, and I knew I was going to prison because prison sentences run in my family. All my family goes to prison, and I didn't know why. I grew up on the outside of town, away from the Atlanta Federal Prison. And to go into town, I would have to go up to the prison, go around it, and then go out the other side. And I used to hate having to drive by that prison. It was scary. I used to drive by there and just sit in my car and tremble. And I didn't know why. I was just ignorant of what was going on. It was just the Atlanta Federal Prison is the ugliest prison I've ever seen in my life. The walls are 100 feet high, and they have a machine gunner at every 50 feet all the way around. It's an ugly place. It used to be. I've been there to an AA meeting now, and it's a pretty nice place. It's warm and receptive. And but I ended up in H&I. When I started, it was called I in Arizona, just institution. Now, the prisoner didn't like to be called I. The people in the hospital didn't like to be called institutionalized people. But my sponsor thought I should go to the Arizona State Prison at Fort Grant, put on an AA meeting. I thought, wow, my sponsor really thinks I've got a great program going here. Now, I told you I had trouble with those steps, and me and God weren't on speaking terms. And but he sent me up there. Much later, I found out why. His sponsor, which had been my grand sponsor, was doing this meeting up there at the Arizona State Prison, and he was old. He was getting old, and he was tired, and he didn't want to do it anymore. And so he made him make me do it so he could get out, and he made me, and I did it, and he retired. He was old. He was 90 years old anyway, but he was going to that meeting every Sunday. And I started going up there. 146 miles each way, buying my own gas. Not because I really wanted to do it. I didn't want to do it, I'll have to be honest. But my family had come back. And the heat was on at my house. I didn't want to be at my house on Sundays when the heat was on like that. So I just wanted to get out of town. And so I was going up there, and we did a lot of first step meetings up there. See, my sponsor shamed me into the first step. I was telling some guys how great my life was and that my life wasn't unmanaged. I'm a former Marine. I'm not powerless. That's the last thing you are if you're a former Marine. My sponsor just, you know how sponsors are. They mess with your life. And so he just kind of broke into the conversation, and he said, well, Bob, if your life is so manageable, why is the police department managing it for you? Sponsors are that way. They just know how to get to you. And then he had to mention how the judicial system was taking measures to manage my life for long periods against my will. So I could see unmanageability had reared its ugly head. I had a little bit of unmanageability in my life. And this is a program of rigorous honesty. And the truth is, I didn't get into trouble every time I drank. But every time I got into trouble, I had been drinking. So alcohol played a very big role in my life. And if I didn't drink alcohol, I wouldn't get into trouble. As a matter of fact, I haven't been arrested a single time since I stopped drinking. Now, I'm monitoring that. That's important to me. I'm amazed. In fact, let me tell you, I'm not a professional speaker, but I have had some interesting experiences in life. I always wanted to be a cop. I don't know why. It's just something. I think in 1948, I was on the school safety patrol, and we went to Washington, D.C. and marched down Pennsylvania Avenue with our new little white shirts, and we were escorted by cops. They took us up there and looked after us and brought us back. So I always wanted to be a cop, but they never come down to the drunk tank looking for a few good men. So I was just kind of passed over. And so here I was, 7 years of sobriety, and I was complaining to this guy that I always wanted to be a cop, but I'm too old. I think I was about 42 or something like that then. And he said, "No, Bob, it doesn't matter how old you are. If you've got the right stuff, they'll take you." So I thought, well, I'll get this out of my system. And I went down to the police department, and I took the test. And it was easy because it's a big 600-question test. But in AA, our code is rigorous honesty. You just tell the truth wherever it takes you. You just go with the truth. And that's what took me through my AA divorce, 2.5 years sober. I just told the truth. And one of us was going to die, so we got an AA divorce. And but I was accepted at the police department, and that surprised me. And then I had to go get a physical. And when I come to AA, I was bleeding from every orifice of my body. I was a physical wreck. But about 7 years had passed. I went to the doctor, and he said, "Bob, you're disgustingly healthy. There's nothing wrong with you. Nothing. See, when I don't drink, I eat good, I work hard, and I sleep good. And that's about all it takes to be healthy." So I started the police academy. And 28 of us recruits started the police academy. It's not like the movie. I'm here to tell you. It's not like the police academy movies. It's entirely different. But April the 20th, 1979, 14 of us were commissioned police officers for the city of Tucson. And I'm here to tell you, it's a long way from the back seat to the front seat of a squad car. But this is one alcoholic that made that trip. Now, I was only a cop for 5 years. I just wanted to see if I had the right stuff. And I watched a lot of cops go from the front seat to the back seat. One drink, and you're on your way to the back seat. And I wondered what I was doing there. And There was so many cops. In my own opinion, 75% of all the cops are alcoholics. What better place to be? If you're an alcoholic, be a cop. Cops don't arrest cops. If you stop another cop for drunk driving, you take him home and put him to bed. You know, in the Marines, we call it esprit de corps. We look after our own. And there's a lot of that going on out there. But I was sitting in an AA meeting one day, and my sergeant walked in to the AA meeting. And it just kind of blew me away. And so, you know, he was squirming, you know, like and after the meeting, I went over and talked to him, and he said, "Man, I don't want to be here." I mean, he was forced to be there because of his behavior. And he said, "The alcoholics are the bad guys, and the cops are the good guys, right?" Not necessarily. So he and I started a meeting for cops only. And I'm here to tell you today there's 75 of Tucson's finest in AA. We also have 12 deputy sheriffs, 6 highway patrolmen, 2 congressmen, 4 alcohol, tobacco, and firearms inspectors. So it's a pretty big meeting. But I was up there at Arizona State Prison, and we were doing first step meetings. I was really into first steps, you know, really into first steps. My sponsor had really embarrassed me good. So one day it happened. I was a couple years sober, and I went in Sunday at 3 o'clock. Old Bob was always there. And as I went in, there's about 60 members of the Arizona State Prison there in AA. They all met me at the front door. Now, that's scary. When you get about 60 inmates in a tight circle and you're in the middle of it. And they said, Bob, we'd like to talk about God. I thought, man, you could have knocked me over with a feather. The last place on earth they'd want to talk about God is Arizona State Prison, right? No, they said, hey, it's full of God stuff and you never talk about God. I didn't think they'd notice. But they noticed. So I did the only thing I could. I said, we'll talk about God next week. This week we're going to talk about the first step. So I went back home to Tucson and I took a crash course in God. Now, if you ever have to take a crash course in God, Alcoholics Anonymous is a good place to do it, because there's a lot of people in AA that know all about God. I knew who they were. I avoided them. I made sure I set 2 seats between me and them, because I thought if they just rubbed me, I'd get it, and I didn't want it. And I knew that we had to hold hands and pray when it was over, so I stayed away from those people. But when I came back, I sought them out. And we had this little cute little gal, a little bit about the same size as Sparky, Sharon. Her name was Midge, and she was a retired prostitute, and she had gotten her life together. She talked about it all the time. She got married and had 2 beautiful little children. And what attracted me to her, except she was good looking, but that's beside the point. She, her higher power was named Charlie Brown. Hey, you can't go wrong there. I said, after the Monday night meeting, I said, Midge, tell me about your higher power. And her eyes got real big, and she said, oh, Charlie Brown, he's keeping me sober. And then she gave me her story about 5 years of sobriety and turning her life around and the whole bit. She was just a little bitty thing, and she said, would you like to see my higher power? And it was too late. I said, yes. So she said, come on. We got in her car, and we went out to the East Lawn Cemetery. It wasn't too far. We were standing there at the front gate looking through the iron bars, and she said, "That you see that big tree back there?" And I said, yeah. She said, that's Charlie Brown. He's keeping me sober. And I thought, uh-oh. So I moved on to someone else. And I'm here to tell you, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has a different concept of a higher power. Some have light bulbs and some have doorknobs, you've heard it. And some have all kinds of... But everybody I talked to referred me to Chapter 4 in the Big Book. Now, I'd never read Chapter 4. It's called We Agnostics. I knew I wasn't one of those. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wasn't one. So I didn't read that one. But they told me I need to read it. And I thought, okay, I'm going to read it. But if it gets spooky, I'm going to quit reading. So I started at the front, and I thought, if they start talking about walking the streets of glory... I'm just going to put it down. And I read the entire 4th chapter, and there wasn't one spooky word in there. Not one. And that amazed me, because You know, there's the people in AA are pretty far out, and they like to talk about their higher power. But I came to the part that says we. What put me to the fourth chapter, what I went looking for, there's two places in the 12 steps, the third and the 11th, where they underline four words. And when they underline words, that means these are important words. You know, study them or something. And the most important word in those four is the word we. And I don't think it's anyone in this room today, but it's the people that wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We. It's God as we understood Him. As they understood Him. The ones who wrote the big book. The we are the ones who wrote the big book. They found a God that works for alcoholics. He might work for non-alcoholics. I don't know. I haven't ventured out there yet. But He works for alcoholics and He works really good. My sponsor said, "Oh, Bob, how long have you been sober?" And I said, "A couple years." He said, "You ever been sober this long before?" And I said, "No." He said, "What's keeping you sober?" I said, "I don't know. I really didn't know." He said, "Why don't you call the thing that's keeping you sober God until you find a better word for it?" And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." So I went looking for the God of the alcoholic. Those guys had their back against the wall and they found a God that worked for them. Most of those people died of old age sober. Now, that's the God I went looking for. And when I read the part that we're thoroughly convinced that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free, I discovered me and God are on the same page. That's all I ever wanted, just to be happy, joyous, and free. And I decided I would give this God of the alcoholic a try, because I had to go back up there to Fort Grant and face those guys. The second step, it took me a couple of years, and I was going to AA meeting. My sponsor told me to go to a meeting every day and don't drink between meetings. And I said, "Yes, sir," and that's what I did. I went every day and I didn't drink between meetings. And I didn't know how it worked. So I used to go to two meetings on Saturday and two meetings on Sunday. 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to about 110. I thought if I miss a meeting, I'd get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk. So I thought if I went to extra meetings, I'd use those as comp days, you know, and I'd comp meetings. If I missed a meeting, I'd use one of those Saturday meetings to fill the hole there. But I never did stop going to meeting. I still go to meeting every day. It's something I got used to. It's like brushing your teeth. If I missed brushing my teeth, they'd just drive me crazy. Hair would grow all over my teeth, and I couldn't stand it. And it's like I can't stand it if I don't go to a meeting every day. It's just what I do. I went long enough to make it a habit. Now I'm hooked. It's a habit. But I turned my life, my will, over the care of God in step three. Now, I was going to tell you about step two. The doors to AA are wide open. They allow any sicko in here. Thank God it was that way when I so desperately needed it. They let me in. It's still that way. And I watched the sickos come in, and I used to take inventories back then. I used to say, "He's not going to make it. There's not enough there to get well. If there was a little more there, he could maybe make it, but he's not going to." And these people would prove me wrong. They would keep coming day after day, and they would clean their act up. They'd clean their life up. We had this one guy. He must have been a salesman because he looked like a salesman. You can tell him. They, you know, fancy pants and white shirts and tied. Well, women take white shirts and wet them and put them in the refrigerator. Now, I've never figured that one out, but that's what they do with them. And this guy, that's what he did with his, but he didn't iron it. He would take it out, and he'd wear it. And it was the ugliest, worst shirt I've ever seen. It was clean, but it was so wrinkled. I couldn't believe it. Well, he looked bad anyway, so it didn't make him look any worse. But one day, this guy showed up with a beautiful iron shirt. And he really looked nice. And a couple weeks later, he had a tie on. This guy started really looking good. And then he got a job. And he started working. And he just, I saw the miracle happen right before my eyes. And I saw it not just once. I like the term the lawyers use, the preponderance of the evidence. If one person gets sober, well, that's nice. And if another one gets sober, well, that's nice. But when you see hundreds get sober, you know, the evidence are overwhelming. So I knew something was going on, and I asked my sponsor about it, and he said, I said, all these people are getting well, but I'm not getting well. He said, oh, if you want to get well, you got to work the steps. You see, he had me. And the guys at Fort Grant had me too. So I decided to turn my life, my will over the care of God, as I'd come to understand Him. God's realm is goodness. There's no pain and suffering connected with God. It's just good things. And so I turned my life, my will over the care of God, and nothing happened. Now, we look back in the literature, and it says, step three calls for affirmative action. You can't just think your way into it. You've got to do something. So, in my living room, I had this great big hoop rug, big round thing, and I just imagined everything good that I could think of. Chocolate ice cream. Fat paychecks. Turkey drumsticks. You know, just everything good in there. There was nothing in there that could hurt me. Just the good stuff. And I stepped over into it. I said, if there's something good going down, count me in. I want to be there. I love good stuff. I've loved good stuff all my life. I can't get enough good stuff. I hate the bad stuff. I hate all the bad stuff. I got scars all over my body. I know what the bad stuff is, and I don't like any of it. And if I never experienced any more bad stuff, that'd be okay with me. But I have asked God for direction. I've asked God to keep me in His realm of goodness where the good stuff happened. Something happened. And I have to share it with you because I was never going to take a fourth step. I wasn't that bad. I didn't have any character defects. But when I took the third step, what happened was I got a surge of courage that came from outside of me into me. What I discovered was I was afraid of step four. And it's difficult for an ex-Marine to admit that he was afraid of anything. And So I wasn't going to do a fourth step. But when I got that surge of courage, I was ready. You know, it was like, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Let's do it. Let's take an inventory. Let's let the chips fall where they may. And I was able to go through those steps. I really appreciate being invited here. And I enjoy talking. For a long time I had nothing to say. But I have so much to say today, and I just want to share it. I've been in corrections ever since I came. I wondered, how can that help me? How can me going to a prison help me with my alcoholism? But it does. Step 12 is we carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The alcoholic sitting on a bar stool isn't necessarily the suffering alcoholic. It's the one sitting in prison, cold sober. I discovered something from the inmates. I wondered what the common denominator was. What brings alcoholics to Alcoholics Anonymous? It isn't fear. Alcoholics aren't afraid of anything. The common denominator is remorse. Remorse cannot be inflicted on anyone. Remorse is self-inflicted. And we get it from, we inflict it on ourselves from living badly or living wrongly or disassociating from the truth. You know, I've spent numerous hours with murderers and rapists and molesters, child molesters, and all kind of people, and bank robbers. I had a friend there in Tucson who was a bank robber, and he robbed a lot of banks, done real good. And he said he come out of the bank there in Phoenix, and there was cops everywhere. Well, he pulled his gun and started shooting. He took 6 rounds, and he was laying there on the sidewalk, bleeding all over the place, thinking, well, this is it. But he didn't die. So he went to prison and served 25 years. And he come to AA in prison. But he had no remorse. That was his money in the bank. All he had to do was go in and take it. No, he had no remorse. But it come around. You know, him serving 25 years in prison and me feeling so bad for puking on the carpet. It was the same amount of remorse. You know, I didn't have to go serve 25 years in prison. But the remorse was the same. Why me? Why is this happening to me? How can I change this? I couldn't change it. There was just no way I could change it. My boss left work early one day, and he, I think he was one of us, but he never come around. And he said, I'm going home early, Bob. He said, you come by my house and pick up your check at 4:30. So I went over there, and I went in, and he was sitting in his chair, and he had a half gallon of one of those good whiskeys. I don't know what a good whiskey, like Jack Daniels or something. And he was just taking pulls on it, you know. And he was feeling pretty good. And he said, stay and listen to Cheech and Chong with him. And so we were listening to Cheech and Chong. And he said, have some whiskey. And I said, you know, I'm really not a whiskey guy. He said, you know what? I've got a gallon of wine. I think Ernest and Julio's name was on it, but it was some beautiful wine, whatever it was. That 1 gallon, and he handed it to him. He said, here, this is yours. And he gave me a big glass, and he said, have a glass. And I did. And I had another glass, and we were sitting there laughing at Cheech and Chong, and I drank that gallon of wine. I could never get enough wine. I love it. And I thought we were doing real good. I had my check in my pocket. And I was introduced to projectile vomiting. Now, I had done a lot of vomiting, but not projectile vomiting. That's the best kind. I mean, it just goes straight out like a fire hose, and it just. He had a white carpet in that room, and that purple vomit went about 20 feet, and that was the last day I worked for him. I never did go back. I couldn't go back. But I hated projectile vomiting. But I had no control over it. I still go to prisons. I've been going to prison since 73. I do 2 prison meetings a week. On Monday morning, I go to the maximum security there in Tucson. 20 years ago, when they built a prison, there was a headlines, no hardened criminals in Tucson. That was a promise to the citizens of Tucson. We were just going to have the nice guys down there. Well, I started the first meeting out there, and I've been going ever since. And then one day I saw them bring in a bunch of guys with, first off, I saw them take the Cimarron unit and cut it in half. And the guys on the north side came in chains. and they were watched very closely, and they were locked away for 24 hours a day. And if they got sick and had to come to the doctor, they came to the doctor in chains. So finally we got a meeting in that unit. And I do a maximum security meeting every Monday morning. And there are people like you and I. They're just alcoholics who drink too much. They're all from California, by the way. They said, no offense intended, but they segregate them over there, and there's so much fighting among the Hispanics, among the blacks, among the whites. They've got these gangs and everything, so they have to segregate everybody. But all these guys that are in the meeting are Hispanic, but they're born in this country, so they all speak perfect English. And they all come, and it's just like a regular AA meeting to me. They just did some pretty serious crimes, and they're paying pretty seriously for it. But every Monday morning, I go to that one, and there's an Indian reservation just west of my ranch, and some guy showed up out there at their prison, and he started a meeting, just out of the blue. And he did the meeting for a year or two, and then I don't know what happened. Nobody will tell me, but they beat him up. I don't know why they beat him up, but it got around to that, and they beat him up, and he left, and he never come back. So they didn't know what to do. So they called GSO, and GSO called Phoenix, and Phoenix called me, because they knew I had a ranch out that way. And I said, sure, I'll go do a meeting out there. So for the past couple of years, I've been taking a meeting in there to the Indians. Because the Tohono O'odham Indian Nation has a little money now. They have a casino. They all have a casino. And they want to keep their own people in their own prison. They have 278 inmates, 24 of which are female. They used to farm them out to the city and the county and the state and let them keep them for $39 a day. But now they want to keep their own. If you're an Indian, commit a crime on your reservation, they keep you there in the prison. And it's a jail slash prison because one guy's doing 12 years, so it's a long-term facility. And you think that that's a different culture, and they are a different culture. They have a different way of thinking. But I just go in and take my little handbook. I open with the first part of chapter 5, the Serenity Prayer, first part of chapter 5, the 12 traditions. And we talk about drinking, and we talk about not drinking, and we read a step, or we read a part of the big book, and we talk about it. And they seem like they're not there. You look in their eyes. They won't look you in the eyes. It's part of their culture. They won't look you in the eye. I don't know what that has to do with it. But when you do look in their eyes, there's no one at home. It's kind of a strange, nobody's home. They're just not listening. But yet, every now and then, the lights will go on in one of them. And they just keep coming back, and then they start talking, and they start looking at you, and they start working this program. And I had started a meeting out there 25 years ago. This wonderful nun, you know, her heart was in the right place, but she wasn't one of us. She had no idea. She took the big book and rewrote it so that a simple mind could understand it. And I took a copy of that book and I sent it to GSO, but I knew that that's not the way to go. They don't have simple minds. They have minds just like you and I. God only created one type of human being, male and female of the species. And when you talk to them about this program of recovery, you know, you get to them. They understand. Even the big words. They will ask me about the big words. Anonymity. Autonomy. One guy asked me the other day, what's balked? I said, that's a good question. You know, it's like a burro who doesn't want to go. He's balking. And he's just fighting you, and he's just not going to let you make him do anything. Some of these we balked. And I told him it was okay to balk. Just not okay to spend a lot of time there. Eventually we got to go forward. A lot of things are changing out there. The meetings are getting bigger. I wanted to tell you at my maximum security prison the other day, something happened. It was severe. The warden's wife is a guard in the maximum security. Now, I don't know what she's doing there, female. Maybe I'm from the old school, but I don't know if women's supposed to be there. In the dining hall, there was a riot. They just wanted to get her, and so they did. They stabbed her four times, and they just started a big fight. But my guys that were coming to the AA meeting, they knew exactly what to do. They knew there was a camera in the corner of every room. Everything was on camera. My guys walked over to the side. And they laid on the floor. They looked at the camera. So, when it was all over, and they took the guys away, my guys all come to the meeting. They knew what to do. This program will let you know what to do in any situation. So, this thing does work. It works all the time for everybody. I don't have an end for my story. I don't know when it's going to end. Life is good for me today. I'm very grateful for the experiences I've had. I've been all over the world. I was talking to Jerry. His name is the most common name in Wales, and my ninth great grandfather came from Wales, so I went over there. I got a chance to go to Wales. My mother's from Ireland, and I went to Ireland, and I never felt so much at home as I was in Ireland. I had three people ask me for directions. When I started talking, they said, "You're not from around here, are you?" But I went to Japan. My son taught in Japan for 2 years. He taught English as a second language. And I went over there for a month. My wife and I toured the entire country of Japan. They're little bitty people. And she could always find me because I was about a foot and a half above all the other people walking around. But I went to Hiroshima, where they dropped the atomic bomb. I remember when that bomb went down, and I applauded. And I still think it was the right thing to do. But I went there, and I saw the devastation. It's unbelievable. 125,000 people killed. I entered Hiroshima by water, and I could see the pillboxes. There was no way that we could ever gone in there in a boat. There was no way that it was so spread out. There was no way we could ever drop enough bombs to slow it down. The atomic bomb was the answer. But I felt right at home over there. I had no apprehension. I went everywhere in that country. I got to know their religion. I spent a lot of time in the cemeteries. You know, they have their way of doing things. I thoroughly enjoy it. I've been all over Mexico, all over Canada. I've been to Alaska. I've been to Hawaii 13 times, and I love Hawaii. But today I'm free, free at last. I can go anywhere and do anything today, as long as I stay close to AA. Thank you all for listening.